It's the moment everyone is waiting for.
Last car approaching the grid.
The tension is high, and so are the stakes.
Cars in formation. We await the green flag at the back.
Everyone holds their breath as the red lights appear, and heartbeats start to thud. And then...
Who's got the launch? It's Charles Leclerc!
Spinning.
It does spin! It's a spin for Max Verstappen! Can the pack avoid him? The Ferrari leads! Antonelli went wide! Max Verstappen spun! And Charles Leclerc takes the lead of the Grand Prix! What a dramatic getaway we've had here!
Yes, the start is one of the most exhilarating moments in Formula One. It's where a race can be won or lost, so the pressure is huge. And not just for the drivers, but also... the woman who makes it all happen. Welcome to F1 Explains. And this is the Circuit de Catalunya, and we are at the 2026 Barcelona Catalunya Grand Prix. Hi everyone, I'm Christian Hugill. My first time at this racetrack, far from my first time in Barcelona. It's a city I absolutely adore, but I've never been to this race before. You're listening to this while the episode is released on a Friday. We're recording this first thing in the morning on a Thursday of a race weekend, media day, which if you were listening a couple of weeks ago, we were talking all about. And it's very much in full setup mode. So we're sat here at the FIA's hospitality building, where Roman from the FIA is currently bringing us some water for the interview we're about to do. Thank you, Roman. Roman, would you like to say hello to the F1 Explains listeners?
Hello, I'm Roman, and I'm press officer for the FIA.
Roman is a wonderful man who's looking after us very well. And opposite Roman, we can see Aston Martin. There is a man in a drawer with a piece of paper and a notebook checking some things that are in that drawer, I presume. He looks very important. We wish him well with his duties. And then next to them is the RB team, who are all donned with VCARB FC for the World Cup, which, of course, is underway by the time you're listening to this. So a little bit of World Cup fever here in the Formula One paddock. As the World Cup starts, we are talking about race starts. Now, we had an email from George in the Netherlands who wants to know about the race starts procedure. So, George, we are devoting this episode to you. He's not the only one. There are plenty of questions you've sent in about all things race starts to f1explains@f1.com. And that is how this podcast works. Send your emails to that address and we find the best people in the paddock to answer those questions. And for a podcast all about the race start, which, let's be honest, can often be the most exciting bit of a race, who better to ask than the person responsible for getting the race underway? I'm not sure I'd want that responsibility, could you imagine? Rebecca Lee is the head of single-seater operations at the FIA and F1's permanent race starter. Rebecca, firstly, a warm welcome to F1 Explains.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by how you answer the question of what you do for a living. When people say, what do? Do you say... well, you know Formula One, you know the start, I do that. Like, how on earth do you explain what you do? Because it's a fantastically niche job.
Yeah, it's not actually the biggest part of my job. It's probably the smallest element of my job.
Really?
Yeah. So I head up the operations for the single-seater department within the FIA. So I have to make sure that we've got all of the relevant facilities in order to run a race weekend. I'm looking after the legal compliance, managing contracts, managing suppliers, budgets, projects, and then I'm also working with the ASN. So when you see all the marshals and
ASNs being,
so all the motorsport, the local motorsport federations. So when you see all of the marshals and the recovery and all the intervention on a race weekend, I've been working with the locals prior to the event, months prior to the event, to ensure that those guys have got exactly what they need.
Can I make a bold guess at something?
Yeah.
You sound like a busy human being.
Very.
Yeah, sounds like a lot. We're obviously on this episode focusing on that small but important part of your job, the start. Let's break it down. Just before the start of the race, the mechanics step away from the cars, the drivers complete a formation lap. Firstly, and we covered this on F1 Explains a couple of weeks ago, but for anyone who might have missed it, why do we have a formation lap when the cars are already on the grid? Like, they're there. Why do we send them round again?
So the formation lap's basically the final check and the final test, so the drivers can make sure that, you know, the cars are operating as they should be. They can warm the brakes, they can warm the tyres, assess the track conditions, and it also gives us, the FIA, an opportunity to make sure that we're happy with everything before we deploy all of our cars at full speed into turn one.
Now, that's what the drivers are doing and what the teams are doing. It's final checks time. It's making sure everything's warmed up and in the right temperature to be able to go racing. What are you doing at that point?
I'm at the start gantry at that point, and I am on the race control channel observing the cars going round to make sure that, you know, we don't need to abort the start or do any intervention. I think there was a couple of years ago one of the drivers crashed on the formation lap, so obviously we had to abort our starting procedure. So at that point I'm alert and observing all of the cars going round, waiting for them to come back to me.
So if that happens, if a driver spins or goes into the tyres or breaks down even, is that your decision to abort the start, or is that someone around you?
So, yeah, obviously when I'm in the start gantry, if I physically see something, then, of course, I'll abort. But if the race director picks it up because they've got more camera visibility, then he'll let me know and say, look, we need to abort, or we might be able to just do an extra formation lap. But, of course, the race director needs to communicate with the locals and the marshals to see how quick we can get the incident recovered. So it's a collective sort of agreement.
And is the race director, because obviously there'll be lots of race officials around, everybody will have different responsibilities. Is the race director sort of the boss in overall charge?
Yeah. So obviously he'll make all of the final decisions, and he's also the safety delegate as well. So that's very critical to all the decisions that are being made.
Very, very important. Now, the cars come back round to their starting positions. What are the rules about where they line up on the grid? Is that the next thing you're thinking about when they've got through the formation lap and everybody's fine?
Yeah, so the tyres need to be within the white lines on the grid. We have grid cameras, so we can check the positioning. We also have got the transponders as well, so we can check if there's been any non-compliant movements. So, yeah, it is quite hard, actually, when you're up there to see exactly, you know, the positioning of the cars. So I am also relying on the marshals to report back to me, and we've got a team of people from the FIA that are on the side of the pit wall as well, and then we've got race control checking the cameras just to make sure that everyone's in position. Monaco, for example, that start finish straight is not actually straight. It goes round on a bend, so it can be optical illusion sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very easy, you know, you can see it, but completely depends on the visibility that we've got. So I am relying on other people on that point as well.
Was Monaco last weekend a busy one for you in that regard?
Yeah, very busy.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple of those things. So, of course, for those that missed it in Monaco last weekend, George Russell was investigated for a potential start line breach. But his wheels were within the white lines of the grid box. So in those situations, you don't get a penalty. But Sergio Perez, unfortunately for Sergio, lost out on Cadillac's first point in Formula One. Why was that, Rebecca?
Pulled up into the wrong grid box. So I don't know if you can see sometimes on TV, we've got our grid lights on the side as well, and that also acts as an aid to the drivers as well, so they can see the grid position that they need to be in. So it's the driver's number and the abbreviation on top of the light. So next time you watch the start, have a look for them.
Were you tempted to let him off because it was Cadillac's first point? I would have been.
That decision is not on me, unfortunately.
No, it's a shame. You're harsh taskmasters here at the FIA. You're all harsh taskmasters. So let's take us back to what would be a normal race start. The cars are all lined up in formation. The medical car is behind the last row, and that's there ready to follow them around in case there are any incidents on lap one. Well, let's be honest, the risk of accidents are highest. We see someone behind that car waving a green flag. Now, Rebecca, just describe where you're positioned at this point, what you have in front of you, who you're in communication with, what happens next?
So I'm stood at the start gantry, of course. All the cars will go into position. We'll see our marshals activate the grid light. So once the driver's in the stationary in the grid box, the grid marshals will activate the lights, so they all come to a 90 degree position. So if we need to deploy a yellow, the drivers behind the driver in that position will see the lights, and we can deploy a cascade. So once all the cars are in position, all the lights, grid lights will go green, flag marshal will wave, and then once the flag marshal at the back's happy that all the cars are in position, because obviously he's got a better visibility than me at the back, I'll communicate to race control that we're good for the pre-start. Once we're good for pre-start, all the grid panels will flash green for 5 seconds, and this will then enable the drivers to prepare the cars, spin the turbos, and then obviously after that, when we deem it's necessary, we will start the start sequence.
The preparing the cars and spinning the turbos, that's different this year, isn't it? That wasn't there that last year. Is that the main difference to the 2026 regulations and the change of start procedure compared to last year?
Yeah.
And just explain the moments of lights out. Now, it's always very exciting for us watching at home. And one thing we've covered on F1 Explains before is when you get the five lights and when they go out, it is a different time from all the lights being on to all of them going out. So the drivers don't get used to it in muscle memory, knowing it's always 1.4 seconds between the last light going on and them going out. Explain how that works. Is it somebody deciding? Is it a computer? How does the lights out and away we go moment work?
So I'll begin the start sequence and then obviously make sure that everything's safe. I'm happy that everyone's prepared and good to go, and then I'll extinguish the lights. So it's all done manually. It's nothing done automatically. It's all me behind the panel.
So, Rebecca, that's your decision as to how long to wait to make the lights go out.
Yep.
That's a lot of power and responsibility. How does it feel?
It is. It's a good feeling, to be honest. Obviously, you get an adrenaline. The sound, you know, when all of the cars are revving up, it's quite unreal. But no, ultimately, all I'm thinking about is keeping everybody safe. So it's relief once everyone gets deployed and everyone's completed lap one. I do get a feeling of relief, and I just always want to ensure that everyone's deployed in a safe manner.
I think if I did it, it'd depend what mood I was in. You know, if I'd had a bad day, I'd be like, I'm going to leave them. I'm going to make them sweat. Yeah. Or I'd just be like, take it off straight away and be like, I'll catch you out. But is there a minimum and maximum amount of time you can leave them for?
No. Again, like, everything goes down to safety. If I need to wait a couple of extra seconds because, you know, we think that there's a gate not closed, or we might see a marshal, or we might see something on track, or I might think that a driver's give us the signal, you know, I'd always, you know, give it a second. We've always got a couple of seconds, so I'd always wait and then obviously extinguish the lights. At the same time, you don't want to unnecessarily make the guys sit there sweating. They spend enough time in them cars during the race, so...
Oh, forget it. They're paid loads. I want to make them sit there longer. It's great fun. And you guys must have to have your eyes and ears to the ground at all points, because the situation's like in Canada where poor Arvid Lindblad was struggling. He couldn't get off the line. Do you have to sort of manually, if you like, keep an eye out for those moments?
Yeah. I was lucky that I seen him, actually, because he didn't wave his hands for very long. It was like a quick wave and then down. At that point in time, I am completely focused. I'm looking at the drivers. I'm looking at the drivers in the cockpit. Obviously, I check, you know, all the areas around. I make sure that everything's safe around. And then before I deploy, before I extinguish the lights, I'm looking at the drivers. So I'm looking up and down the grid at the guys in the cockpit. And that's when I seen Arvid wave his hands.
You do get taught about that right from the grassroots of motorsport. I did a bit of racing when I was a kid, which our listeners get bored of me talking about. But it didn't last long, Rebecca. I wasn't very good. There's a reason I'm talking about it now. But you are actually genuinely told, like, if your kart or your car is stricken, wave like a mad person, because people like you need to spot them. So we'll pass that on to Arvid. In future, Arvid, bit of a bigger wave from you would be helpful.
Please.
Thank you very much. Now, let's get on to some listener questions. F1 Explains at F1.com. Shanna is from North Carolina. Shanna has asked you, Rebecca, what happens if a driver moves before the lights go out? How is it detected?
So we've got transponders. If there's a move detected, the report will automatically come through, and then we can review that with the stewards. So with our grid cameras, any onboard cameras, the telemetry... And then obviously it'll be a combination of the report from the transponders and obviously all of the infrastructure that we use for additional checks with the stewards.
And what about the cars starting the race from the pit lane? How is it different for them?
Well, obviously if a car's starting from the pit lane, they'll still join the formation lap. And then once the last cars cross the pit exit, I'll release the car, I'll release the driver. Canada's a little bit different, actually. If I'm releasing the driver from the pit lane, basically the pit exit line is shorter than going around turn one. Ultimately, it means the driver would get there quicker than the drivers that are starting on the grid. So I need the race director to let me know when to release the driver
from
the
course.
Pit lane.
That makes perfect sense. And there are times when you'll need another formation lap. In fact, we've just mentioned Arvid Lindblad at the Canadian Grand Prix. That's one very good example. What's the procedure for something like that? In what circumstances would you, by the rule book, say, right, we need another formation lap?
So exactly what happened in Canada. So if there's a driver waving his hands, he's got a problem, we do an extra formation lap in the hope that during the formation lap, we can get the car off the grid in the relevant time before the other drivers get back to the starting grid. Obviously, in Canada, we didn't achieve that just due to the positioning of the gates and things like that. So, yeah, otherwise, you know, if there's something more sinister than, you know, just a driver's got an issue, we'd just abort the start and then we'd have to redo the starting procedure.
Right, sure, sure. And they'll go back to the pit lane in that eventuality if it's completely aborted.
No, so if it's... They only go back to the pit lane when we've red flagged.
Fine.
So obviously if we get on track and, I don't know, there might be somebody on track, a fan might have gone on the track, for example.
Yes, sure.
And so we don't want to do an extra formation lap. We don't want the cars going near the people. We need to find out where the problem is. So we'll abort completely. The cars will stay where they are. And then all the teams, the engineers will come back onto the grid and we redo the starting procedure. And then we need to give the teams at least a 10-minute warning prior to the new official start time.
I'm with you. But the difference between what I was getting mixed up with is the red flag when the race is stopped, that's when
exactly.
They go into the pits.
Yep.
But if it's a race if the race has been aborted, it's a more simple case of stay where you are, guys, everybody yep. comes
if
to you.
If the start's been aborted.
Yeah, yep. That makes sense. Now, once the race has started and the race is underway, is it time for you to switch off a little bit? I'm guessing not. Given the description of your job, it doesn't sound like you ever switch off.
Unfortunately not. No, so I'm listening into the race control channel. And of course, I'm watching the race. And as we add in Monaco, if there's a red flag, I need to be there on standby and ready and prepared to do any race resumptions.
Because we do see that. I mean, Monaco is a good example where we had the red flag. When a race is starting under the safety car, how's that different in terms of what you do? And also, why would a race start under the safety car?
Obviously, I'd need to make sure that I program the start system under a safety car start. And sometimes we do it, so if it's wet conditions, sometimes we want the drivers to go around and do multiple laps behind the safety car so they can get used to the track conditions, or maybe we want to clear some standing water off the racing line. And then obviously, if we're going to do a rolling start, if the starting grid's not equally parts wet on both sides, we don't want to do a race start because it'd be unfair on one half of the grid and not the other.
Yeah,
so yeah, the protocol's pretty much the same. I just need to manipulate the system with some additional steps, but yeah, at the end goal is still the same, you know. There's nothing drastic that changes.
George in the Netherlands has emailed and said, watching on TV we hear the heartbeat noise when the five red lights come on at the start. Can the drivers hear that?
I didn't even know there was a heartbeat at the start. I've got headset on and I'm listening to various different channels, so I can't hear anything else outside of what's going through my headset apart from the engines.
I will be honest, me and Rebecca spoke a little bit about this before we started recording. Obviously for us fans watching at home, the sort of heartbeat noises have become an iconic part of our weekend. And there's Rebecca at the heart of the action said to me, didn't know we had them. So for you, it is just lights, isn't it? There's
yeah.
no sound effects or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And the start procedure's moved on quite heavily, hasn't it? Back in the 1950s, when the F1 World Championship began, the race was started by just a bloke waving a flag. And then in the 70s, lights started to be used. Red lights came on above the starting grid. Then green lights came on below to signal the start of the race. The current system of five red lights coming out one by one, then all going out, was first used in 1996. Rebecca, why is that a good start procedure? Why does it work? Why have we stuck with it since, you know, a few decades ago, back in the 90s?
I think the main aspect of that is safety. We've got repeater lights as well, so for the drivers that are further back on the grid.
Yes, there's a second set.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it makes it more fair, and same again, safety. I spoke earlier about the transponders of the cars, you know, to detect any false starts and movements. Them transponders are also linked to the start lights, so we can see where in the start sequence, if someone's crept forward, you know, the drivers are getting themselves prepared with the clutch and things like that. So sometimes there can be accidental movements, but ultimately, you know, like all of our systems are pretty much linked and speaking to each other. So we've got one system to detect a certain element, but also, you know, the lights are also supporting that other software and technology that we've got in place. So I definitely think it's a good thing.
Rebecca, we speak to Formula One drivers on this podcast, but frankly, we hear a lot from them. So one thing we try and do is speak to people who you don't normally get to hear from, and we would put you in that category. Now, often our listeners are very intrigued as to how people like you got into this mad Formula One world. How on earth did you do a journey to eventually becoming in charge of the Formula One start procedure, plus all the many other things that are in your job role? How did you get into something like this?
I never planned it.
I don't think you could plan it, could you? Yeah. It'd be a very niche plan, wouldn't it?
When I was younger, I never thought, right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be the F1 race starter.
What do you want to do when you grow up? You know the start of F1 races?
So I started with the FIA in 2022. Prior to that, I was a supplier to the FIA. I used to do the installation. You know, I spoke about the grid lights earlier on the side of the pit wall, and we've got like the information panel on the starting gantry. So I actually used to do like the installations there, like all of the electrical installations. And then I started, you know, doing the training with the marshals. And then I started to do the support category. So I was doing the race starts for Porsche, W Series at the time, F2 and F3. And then got asked if I'd be interested in stepping up to do F1.
Sounds a fascinating job. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I love it. I'm blessed. I'm very lucky.
Now, this podcast is a very international listenership. So you're from the northeast of England, right?
Yeah.
It's an unusual accent to hear in this paddock. Graham Loudon, the team boss of Cadillac, is another one who has it. But for those that aren't aware, the northeast accent is often known as the friendliest in the UK.
I never knew that, but that's nice to know, yeah.
Often called Geordie, for those that don't know. Geordie people are generally delightful. It is a very friendly accent. But you were saying that people around here think you have an accent, but when you go home, they don't think you've got the accent anymore.
No, I think I speak too slow when I go home, and when I come here, everyone thinks I speak too fast.
Well, I've got a very Midlands accent, and people say the same to me. I go home and say, you've not got an accent. Then when I'm around people in this paddock, they go, oh, you sound really Midlands. So must be something about it. It's a fascinating journey. And as I say, we love on this podcast sort of shining a light on people you don't usually get to hear from. So it's been lovely to hear your story, Rebecca, and how you got into this ridiculous world of Formula One, but also really appreciate your insights into how you do your really cool job. So thank you for coming on F1 Explained.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I love a niche Formula One job. Rebecca's job's absolutely fascinating. And again, another reoccurring theme of what we often see in this podcast. Sorry, I'm going to interrupt myself. I mentioned at the start of the show that everybody's sort of building the circuit for the weekend because we're here early on a Thursday morning. A little pickup truck has just drove past us with two absolutely massive potted plants. And it's only in the Formula One paddock could a pickup truck be going on the right side of the paddock with a load of potted plants. And then on the left, somebody wheels down Esteban Ocon's soft tyres for the weekend. It's just the strange world of the Formula One paddock. Anyway, what was I saying? Yes, a lot of people in Formula One have two or three jobs. And that Rebecca's so important job of the race start is just one element of a lot of what she does. And last year on the podcast, in fact, we put it on the feed this year, we recorded an episode inside the garage with the Haas team. And again, so many of the people we met in that episode have such an important job on the pit stops, for example, but then do so many other things across the course of the weekend. People in this paddock tend to be multi-talented people, is what we've learnt. And speaking of multi-talented people, we know our listeners are wonderful, multi-talented people listening all over the world. A little message from Kim in California. Kim says, hi, Christian. I recently started watching F1 because my partner is obsessed with it. He even took me to my first race last weekend in Monaco. F1 Explains is really helping me understand what's going on. There's so much to learn, but thanks to this podcast, I'm keeping up. Kim in California, that is exactly what we are here for. And any questions you've got, it can be about literally anything in Formula One. There'll be some times on this podcast where we talk to drivers. We had Lando Norris on last season, for example. Plenty of times we'll talk to Formula One drivers, but sometimes we need to dig into the role of someone who you'd never normally get to hear from, like Rebecca, and that's what we did this week. Lovely stuff. Well, enjoy this weekend. I know I will. I'm looking forward to seeing whether Kimi Antonelli can keep going with this frankly ridiculous winning record of his. And we will debrief all the action on F1 Nation with Tom Clarkson. And I'm guessing producer James Hinchcliffe will join Tom Clarkson this weekend. Yes, lovely. There you go. I'm learning. And of course, there is Tom's other podcast, our sister podcast, Beyond the Grid. Producer Jamie often at this point tells us who's coming up on Beyond the Grid as he produces it as well. Jamie, hi.
Hello, Christian. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. Who's on Beyond the Grid?
Well, it's a man who's going to make some history this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Alex Albon is going to become the driver with the most race starts in Williams history. So it's him, of course.
What a man. We love Alex Albon. I hope it was pure chaos, like the couple of times we've had Alex Albon on this podcast. A very famous moment of this podcast is where we walked in to use the loo when we were interviewing James Vowles, because there were the loo wasn't in James's office, but it was within the building structure. Anyway, that happened. Have a look on my social media for that. Alex Albon is one of my favourite people to interview. That will be fantastic. Make sure you check out Beyond the Grid with TC. Of course, you can keep up with all the action on F1 TV, depending on where you are in the world, and there'll be highlights on F1's YouTube channel as well. And we have new episodes every week, so we will be back next Friday to explain some more things from the wonderful world of Formula One. I'm Christian Hugill from Spain. Speak to you soon. Bye for now.